hot or freezing rain, freezing fog tonight. Temperatures in the 40s to low 50s today. Tonight, in the low to mid 30s. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm Jim Thompson. William C. Rogers of Prescott, Arizona, was in jail on suspicion of sabotage in the firebombing of a government wildlife lab in Washington State. He committed suicide in his cell yesterday. Rogers was being held in an individual cell. Rogers placed a plastic bag over his head and suffocated himself while alone in his cell. He was one of six people arrested earlier this month, suspected of sabotage attacks in Oregon and Washington in recent years. Rogers was implicated in the 1998 arson of the Agriculture Department's Animal and Plant Health Inspection Services facility in Olympia, Washington, and a Colorado ski resort. Chelsea Gerlach, also charged with similar property crimes, was placed under suicide watch. Gerlach has been denied bail because authorities fear that she might flee, the story from the German version of the Short News website.
The Environmental Protection Agency 2 weeks ago announced new safety requirements for U.S. cities with unfiltered water supplies to prevent disease caused by waterborne pathogens. The city of Portland is resisting these requirements and has said they will go so far as to sue the federal government to prove that their water should be exempt from the new regulations. FSRN's Julie Sabatier has more.
Cryptosporidium is a waterborne pathogen that, according to the Center for Disease Control, is the most common cause of disease outbreak related to public drinking water. This is why the Environmental Protection Agency has issued a regulation to protect cities with unfiltered water systems from an outbreak like the one that hit Milwaukee in 1993, infecting over 400,000 people.
We have the cleanest water in the world.
That's Randy Leonard, City Commissioner for Portland, Oregon, in charge of the city's Water Bureau.
When we get our drinking water here at our tap, there is no contamination possible from Cryptosporidium.
Portland's federally protected watershed, the Bull Run Reservoir at the base of Mount Hood, is safe from livestock and sewage, which are the most common sources of the pathogen. After this argument failed in negotiations with Washington, the city of Portland is gearing up to sue the federal government rather than comply with the EPA regulations that would require water treatment or filtration. Mike Gerhard heads the EPA Office for Water Quality in the Pacific Northwest. He says the science is not accurate enough to rule out other sources of contamination.
There are a number of highly protected surface water systems, watersheds around the country, including Seattle's and other places, and they are not opposing the major provisions of this rule.
Commissioner Leonard explains why Portland has chosen to resist the regulation.
We're not challenging the rule per se. We're actually saying the rule is fine, but that we believe that we comply with it with our ecosystem that exists in Mount Hood. I just see this as a really unnecessary expense that only enriches the contractor that would install the filter system. That's the only entity that would benefit.
Floyd Jones with the environmental organization Friends of the Reservoir says she supports the city's position.
Every environmental group is in agreement on this in the community. There's no dissension. If the only people that are going to benefit from this are the consultants, then why are we going to spend all that money when we have a water system that has significant needs in terms of maintenance?
Filtration or treatment could cost the city as much as $200 million, causing a spike in water and sewage rates. Director of the Portland Water Users Coalition, Kent Crayford, says rates would most likely go up by 74%.
When it comes to making trade-offs on a residential level for low-income people, you know, they're already strapped. And when it comes to business, I mean, this means jobs for a lot of businesses.
Crayford, along with representatives from other advocacy groups and environmental organizations, sits on the committee that will choose the firm to represent the city of Portland when it files suit against the EPA and the federal government in the new year. For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Julie Sabatier in Portland, Oregon.
In Oregon, a state commission voted yesterday to adopt car and truck emissions rules modeled on California's. The action extends the stringent standards to the entire Pacific coast from Mexico to Canada. The rules were adopted temporarily. The Oregon Environmental Quality Commission now has 180 days to make them permanent. That is expected to happen. The tougher rules will also take effect in Washington State. The Washington legislature has already approved the stricter standards, but to ensure a regional approach, conditioned their implementation on similar action in Oregon. Governor Ted Kulongowski has recommended the stricter California standards for cars and light trucks beginning with the 2009 model year to help reduce pollution blamed for global warming. Still pending is a court challenge to Kulongowski's request by opponents, including the Alliance of Automobile Manufacturers. Marion County Circuit Judge Mary James is not expected to rule until mid-January on the lawsuit. The Federal Clean Air Act allows only California to set tougher emission standards than federal law, but other states are free to adopt its standards. Commission Chairman Mark Reeves said states are taking the initiative because the federal government has been slow to respond to global warming.
While debate over immigration was prominent in the House of Representatives recently, local communities continue to grapple with the issues locally. The bill that passed in the House a week ago would treat undocumented workers as felons, and no provision for guest worker programs touted by President Bush were included. FSRN's Christy Lipuma-Herrera and Darby Hickey bring us an update on how undocumented workers in Northern Virginia are dealing with the limited options presented to them.
Pues ahorita es primer día que vengo acá, porque bueno, ya dije, voy a ir a ver cómo está la onda ya.
It's a cold first morning for Fernando at the New Herndon Official Workers Center, which opened a week ago. More than 50 day laborers huddle in groups while few contractors come through the parking lot where the men wait. Some gather around the heater blasting warm air, others order food from the vendor who sells pupusas and hot drinks. In the middle of the lot, the former site of a police station, a group of workers hover around a table that determines their employment for the day, a ticketed lottery system. Wilfredo, who looked for work in past years at the unofficial site outside 7-Eleven, says the new center is a marked contrast.
I think this is a good system, but here it's just about luck. Whoever has their number drawn gets to work. For me, though, it's better because the old site was a lot more risky. Things are better here.
The controversial center opened against the wishes of some Herndon residents who did not want taxpayer money to support what they saw as a hub for undocumented workers. This past week, while opponents protested at the site, 45 minutes away in Washington, D.C., Congress members on Capitol Hill passed a bill that would have significant negative impact on the lives of these workers. David, who has done day labor for 2 years, says the government should be looking at solutions that account for the reality of undocumented workers who are already here and an important part of the U.S. society and economy.
I think they should look for a situation that's fair for everyone. Because we're looking for work and they're judging us like terrorists, we don't have anything to do with that. To pass laws against Latinos with the excuse of making anti-terrorist laws, I don't think that's fair.
Despite the lack of jobs for the moment, a lot of workers at the new center express hope that contractors will start coming more often as the seasons change, that planned center services like English and vocational classes will happen, and that government policies will improve. Again, David.
Uno trabaja para los americanos, hispanos, o los que vengan, va.
We work for Americans, Latinos, or whoever comes looking for workers, but we do it to lend them a hand, and they lend us a hand. Like it or not, they depend on us, and we also need them.
For Free Speech Radio News, I'm Christy Lipuma Herrera with Darby Hickey in Herndon, Virginia.
The Bush administration formally defended its domestic spying program in a letter to Congress last night. The administration said the nation's security outweighs privacy concerns of individuals who are monitored. In a letter to the chairs of the House and Senate Intelligence Committees, the Justice Department said President Bush authorized electronic surveillance without first obtaining a warrant in an effort to thwart terrorist acts against the United States. President Bush has acknowledged he authorized such surveillance and repeatedly has defended it in recent days. The letter was the administration's first public notice to Congress about the program, in which electronic surveillance was conducted without the approval of a secret court created to examine requests for wiretaps and searches in the most sensitive terrorist and espionage cases.
According to the Bloomberg News Service, the U.S. House of Representatives passed a one-month extension of the Anti-Terror USA Patriot Act. The House rejected a six-month measure agreed to last night by the Senate. Democrats and some Republicans concerned over loss of civil liberty succeeded in blocking a full renewal of the legislation. Republican James Sensenbrenner, chairman of the House Judiciary Committee, shortened the Senate's six-month extension to just 1 month. The shortened extension would focus the Senate's attention on renewing the law. If the Senate agrees to the change, both houses of Congress would have to resume negotiations on the measure when they return to work next month. Yet Sensenbrenner indicated little flexibility in his position of supporting a full renewal, as specified in a conference report worked out by House and Senate Republican leaders. Sensenbrenner said Bush administration officials told him they were prepared to call a special session of Congress next week if the Patriot Act was not renewed, and that he agreed to an extension until February 3rd to avoid that.
According to the LA Times, the leaders of New York's striking transit workers voted to return their members to work on the third day of a union walkout that has shut down the nation's largest subway and bus system. Some bus and subway service could resume later today after the board of the Transit Workers Union Local 100 ended the walkout, as the union and the city's transit authority agreed to restart contract talks. Earlier today, state mediators announced the first major breakthrough in the labor dispute after the TWU and the Metropolitan Transit Authority agreed to resume negotiations. However, the resumption of negotiations does not mean that both sides are close to resolving the dispute. While the Transit Authority continues to demand concessions on pension benefits, it has agreed to discuss alternative ways to cut costs and improve its financial future. But the TWU decision to end the strike was not unanimous. The transit workers initially sought a 24% wage increase over 3 years. The MTA offered them 10. State officials also want future transit employees to pay for part of their health benefits. Mainstream news largely ignored the legitimate demands made by the transit workers. Programming instead focused on the inconvenience caused to holiday shoppers and the loss of revenue to New York.
The relationship between money and power in Washington is coming under increased scrutiny. California Republican Representative Randy Cunningham faces 10 years in prison for taking $2.4 million in bribes to help secure Defense Department contracts. The Justice Department also is seeking to prove that other lawmakers accepted campaign contributions, lavish trips, and other gifts from former lobbyist Jack Abramoff in return for favorable treatment for his clients. Abramoff's expected cooperation in the probe could spell trouble for Ohio Republican Representative Bob Ney, also former House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, who have ties to Abramoff. The investigation has highlighted the close relationship between members of Congress and the 27,000 registered lobbyists who shower them with sports tickets and other perks. Lobbying firms took in more than $2 billion in 2004.
A New Orleans union official vowed to fight the firings of two police officers accused in the beating of a man in the French Quarter shortly after Hurricane Katrina. The October 8th beating of 64-year-old Robert Davis was photographed and videotaped by the Associated Press. Two officers, Robert Evangelist and Lance Schilling, were fired Wednesday, and a third officer, Stuart Smith, was suspended for 120 days. The confrontation renewed long-standing allegations of racism, brutality, and corruption in the New Orleans Police Department. The three officers are white, and Davis is black. Davis said he does not believe race was an issue in the beating. Evangelist and Schilling were accused of battery against Davis. Smith was accused of battery against a reporter. All three officers had been suspended without pay since the incident. They have pleaded not guilty to the charges. The Associated Press television news tape shows an officer hitting Davis at least four times in the head. Davis appeared to resist, twisting and flailing as he was dragged to the ground by four officers. One of the officers kneed Davis and punched him twice. Davis was face down on the sidewalk with blood streaming down his arm and into the gutter. Smith ordered APTN producer Rich Matthews and the cameraman to stop recording. When Matthews held up his credential, the officer grabbed the producer, leaned him backward over a car, jabbed him in the stomach, and unleashed a profanity-laced tirade.
A jury in California has determined that Walmart stores must pay $172.3 million to California workers it illegally prevented from taking meal breaks. The verdict came after a three-month trial in a lawsuit accusing Walmart of failing to give as many as 116,000 current and former employees lunch breaks or compensation for not taking the breaks between 2001 and 2005. The jury awarded $115 million in punitive damages and $57.3 million in compensatory damages to the workers. The verdict is the second in more than 40 similar suits pending against Walmart across the country. It will give company critics ammunition in attacks on the company's labor practices. Walmart also faces a sexual discrimination lawsuit filed on behalf of as many as 1.6 million female workers. Walmart stores has denied breaking the law and plans to appeal the ruling. Under California law, employees who work more than 5 hours must get a 30-minute break. Workers who don't get the break get an extra hour's work to pay. Walmart's own policies prohibit employees from working off the clock and say that workers whose breaks or meals are interrupted to perform work will be paid for the missed time off. This according to the Bloomberg News Service.
A New England Journal of Medicine report on Tamiflu, the drug most of the world is counting on to prevent an avian flu pandemic, may not be a fail-safe defense. This from the website ctv.ca. The authors say they have found evidence the H5N1 virus can mutate into a form unaffected by Tamiflu, rendering the world's ever-growing stockpile of the drug ineffective if the mutated strain were to spread. The study, done by Dr. Menno De Jong at the Hospital for Tropical Diseases in Ho Chi Minh City, said 4 out of 8 avian flu patients who were given the medication died despite the treatment. Another article in the same journal cautions doctors against prescribing the drug for patients to stockpile. It says if not administered in large enough dose, the chemical structure of Tamiflu could allow the virus to develop a resistance to the treatment. Bird flu has not yet appeared in North America, and there is no proof that it can spread from person to person, but officials worry that if the virus mutates, it could become as contagious as the annual flu, but much more deadly. Since 2004, the H5N1 virus has killed at least 71 people in Asia. According to figures updated by the World Health Organization, there have been at least 139 human cases.
A Denver lawyer was pardoned Tuesday by George Bush for drug-related crimes she committed more than 2 decades ago, according to the Rocky Mountain News. According to the U.S. Department of Justice, in 1984, Wendy St. Charles was sentenced to 4 years in prison in Illinois for conspiracy to conduct a narcotics enterprise and distribution of cocaine. She was also put on 4 years of special parole and 4 years of probation, which were to run consecutively with her sentence. Currently, St. Charles is a licensed attorney who works for MDC Holdings, the largest Denver-based home building firm and one of the top 10 home builders in the U.S. Larry Meisel, chair of the MDC Holdings Company, and his wife Carol are major supporters of the Republican Party and its candidates, donating thousands of dollars to their campaigns. The White House gave no details as to why St. Charles was granted the pardon now.
Congress rejected a request by the Bush administration for war-making authority in the United States in negotiations over the joint resolution passed days after September 11, 2001, according to an opinion article by former Senate Majority Leader Thomas Daschle in today's Washington Post. Daschle's disclosure challenges a central legal argument offered by the White House in defense of the National Security Agency's warrantless wiretapping of U.S. citizens and permanent residents. It suggests that Congress refused explicitly to grant authority that the Bush administration now asserts is implicit in the resolution. In a letter to Congress, the Justice Department acknowledged that the President's October 2001 eavesdropping order did not comply with the procedures of the law that has regulated domestic espionage since 1978. The Foreign Intelligence Surveillance Act, or FISA, established a secret intelligence court and made it a criminal offense to conduct electronic surveillance without a warrant from that court, quote, except as authorized by statute. The letter asserted that Congress implicitly created an exception to FISA's warrant requirements by authorizing Bush to use military force in response to the destruction of the World Trade Center and a wing of the Pentagon. The congressional resolution of September 18, 2001, made no reference to surveillance or to the president's intelligence-gathering powers, and the Bush administration made no public claim of new authority until news accounts disclosed the secret NSA operation. Republican legislators involved in the negotiations could not be reached for comment.
According to a press release from People for the American Way, On the same day, the Senate passed legislation that cuts public education funding. It also voted to establish the first ever national private school voucher program. The move is part of the final appropriations measure for the Department of Defense. With final approval in the House today, Congress has signed off on this dangerous measure under the guise of one-time relief for students affected by this year's hurricanes. The voucher program diverts funds from public schools and allows federally funded private schools to discriminate on the basis of religion when hiring teachers. It also fails to protect against the use of federal funds for the religious indoctrination of students. People to Whom at the American Way's Ralph Neer said, "The promise of a quality public education for every child is a cornerstone of our democracy. But private school vouchers divert money from public schools and undermine that promise. Most Americans oppose such voucher programs, which might be why this one was attached to a must-pass defense appropriations bill. This program throws open the door to using taxpayer dollars to fund private schools. It also allows for government funding of religion and religious discrimination. We deeply regret its passage."
The UN is facing an impending financial crisis which could shut down the world body come January. This from Interpress Service. The potential crisis has been sparked by implicit threats by the United States that it will not support the UN's biennial budget for 2006-2007 if member states refuse to back proposals for a radical overhaul of the world body, including management reforms. Since the budget is traditionally approved by consensus by all 191 member states, a single country can withhold its support, thereby throwing the entire process into disarray. John Bolton, the abrasive U.S. ambassador to the United Nations, has said the UN's biennial budget for 2006-07 should be shrunk to a three-month budget, giving member states a deadline of March 31st to agree on a set of U.S.-inspired reforms. But the 132-member group of 77, comprising developing countries, is refusing to conform to artificial deadlines or rush into a decision under threat. The group of 77 says that UN reforms are primarily driven by right-wing neoconservatives in the United States who have made UN bashing into a fine art. Last month, Bolton warned UN member states, specifically the 132 developing nations, that if they don't play ball with the United States, Washington may look elsewhere to settle international problems. The G77 told Annan that it is strongly opposed to the neoconservative view that the world body should run like a U.S. corporation, with the Secretary General playing the role of CEO.
CIA Director Porter Goss recently visited Ankara, Turkey. He reportedly brought three dossiers on Iran with him, which stated that Iran has nuclear weapons, was supporting terrorism, including the PKK and Al-Qaeda, and that Tehran sees Turkey as an enemy. Goss is said to have asked for Turkey's support, though, against Iran's nuclear activities, and asked Ankara to be ready for a possible U.S. air operation against Iran and Syria. Government spokesman General Sicek said, "There are important developments and movements in the region. Turkey's exchange of information with the CIA comes from this and is normal." This, according to TurkishPress.com.
A U.S. Marine is under official investigation for murder by Italian magistrates over the killing of an Italian agent in Iraq earlier this year, according to Reuters. Intelligence officer Nicola Calipari was shot dead at an improvised U.S. checkpoint on a road near Baghdad in March as he was accompanying an Italian hostage to safety. Italy and the United States held a joint inquiry into the incident, but they failed to agree joint conclusions and instead issued conflicting reports. While the U.S. military exonerated its troops of any blame, Rome said nervous, inexperienced American soldiers and a badly executed roadblock were at the root of the shooting. In the meantime, Italy's independent judiciary has pushed ahead with their own probe and have carried out forensic tests on the car Calipari was traveling when he came under fire.
An Italian judge has issued arrest warrants for 22 purported CIA operatives in connection with the alleged kidnapping of an Egyptian cleric in 2003. Prosecutors say the warrants allow for the arrest of the suspects in any of the 25 European member countries. Italian officials previously issued warrants that allowed the suspects to be arrested only in Italy. Italy already has sought the extradition of the 22. The cleric, believed to belong to an Islamic terror group, was allegedly abducted on a Milan street before being flown to Egypt, where he was reportedly tortured.
Sunni Arab and secular parties in Iraq have united to reject the results of last week's parliamentary elections, according to The Guardian. They are saying that there was widespread fraud. Representatives from 35 parties issued a statement threatening to boycott the new parliament if their complaints were not properly investigated. Iraq's Election Commission says it has received complaints but does not think the overall result will be affected. The final results are expected to be announced at the beginning of January. Partial results released by the Independent Electoral Commission of Iraq this week suggested that the Shia-led United Iraqi Alliance would maintain its dominance in the new Council of Representatives.
OPEC officials have arrived in Beijing for the first formal talks between the oil-producing cartel and China, according to the BBC. Chinese leaders are keen to secure supplies of oil to fuel the country's rapidly expanding economy. OPEC, meanwhile, wants to develop closer ties with the world's second largest oil consumer. With world oil supplies currently stretched, OPEC says it wants to gain a better understanding of China's appetite for oil. Oil-producing nations are facing an investment bill for billions of dollars to ramp up production at oil fields in a bid to meet soaring demand. Leading exporter Saudi Arabia has been at the forefront of OPEC nations calling on consumers to draw up a roadmap on their energy needs. The OPEC meetings in China come as Chinese figures suggest the country is continuing to climb up the world economic rankings.
Nigeria's president Olusegun Obasanjo has put security forces on high alert in the Niger Delta region after an attack on a key oil pipeline. This according to the BBC. Obasanjo gave the order at a meeting with security and intelligence officials in the capital, Abuja. The apparent dynamite attack killed at least 8 people and is expected to delay deliveries of more than 180,000 barrels per day for up to a week. Pipelines have been attacked in the region a number of times before. In other instances, pipelines have been cut by thieves to siphon off the oil. Some local residents have long claimed that they do not benefit from the oil wealth. All defense and security personnel in the region to be placed in a state of high alert. The attack occurred west of the Shell Oil Center at Port Harcourt. Previously, unknown militia group calling itself the Martyrs Brigade has claimed responsibility for the attack. After the incident, Anglo-Dutch Shell had to shut down 2 wells that supply the pipeline in the Niger Delta. The company invoked a force majeure to formally delay the shipments of oil. This is a legal term allowing a company to release itself from a contract due to unforeseen circumstances beyond its control. Nigeria is the world's 8th largest oil producer and the largest in Africa.
This has been the KBOO Morning News for Friday, December 23rd, 2005. Chris Andre, Kathleen Stevenson, Brian Smith edited the news. Kay Booth's volunteer audio engineers edited the tape. Kay Booth's intrepid reporters contributed local stories. Kathleen Stevenson is the AM News and Public Affairs Director, and Brian Smith is on the board right now. I'm Chris Andre.
And I'm
Jim Thompson.
We welcome your participation in this program. To volunteer, call us at 503-231-8032. Or you can reach us by email at www.kboo.org. Or drop by the station at 20 Southeast 8th Avenue. Check out our new improved website at www.kboo.fm. We clear the air at 90.7 FM in Portland, 100.7 FM in Corvallis on Translator K264 AA, 91.9 FM in Hood River on Translator K220 HR. And be sure to join us at 5 p.m. for a solid hour of solid news every afternoon, except for this one prior to Christmas. Portland area weather, cloudy, fog or freezing fog tonight, temperatures in the 40s to low 50s today, tonight in the mid to low 30s.
And coming up this morning on KBOO at 7:30, Ani and Melody host Positively Revolting Talk Radio. At 9, Cherie Blackfeather hosts the KBOO Report with more on KBOO and community radio throughout the world. At 10, Parafaggering hosts a show on Syria, Lebanon, and the assassinations. 10:30, Pat McGuire hosts a special holiday Boneheads and Bigots show with a musical guest. And at 11, it's Democracy Now! And tonight, the KBOO Evening News is preempted for a special by Free Speech Radio News, Iraq, A Year in Review, followed by Counterspin. And I'm Jim Thompson.
I'm Sandra.
This is the KBOO Community Calendar for Friday, December 23rd. Right now, the Oregon Community Warehouse, which donates furniture and basic household items to families and individuals, is in need. The Oregon Community Warehouse is in great need of more blankets, towels, pots, and pans. Each week, they can only supply these sorts of household items to about 60 families a week, but have hundreds of requests weekly. The Oregon Community Warehouse is located at 2267 North Interstate and accepts donations weekdays 9 a.m. to 5 p.m. They also can be reached on their website at www.OregonCommunityWarehouse.org or by phone at 503-235-8786. The Clackamas Repertory Theater presents A Christmas Carol at the Clackamas Community College. This adaptation will return audiences to the real spirit of Charles Dickens' holiday classic. Tonight at 7 p.m. is the last showing. Prices are $10 students, $12 seniors, and $15 general admissions. Clackamas Community College is located at 19600 South Malala Avenue, Oregon City. For more info, call 503-657-6958, extension 2356. The Grotto Christmas Festival Lights is having a canned food drive which supports Snowcap Community Charities. Visitors are asked to bring canned or dry baby food to the Grotto. The Grotto is located on North 85th and Sandy Boulevard. Tickets are $7 adults, $3 children. They're open 5 to 9 p.m. For more info, call 503-261-2400 or go to www.thegrotto.org. One can see models of early steamboats and sailing vessels, tour the Maritime Library, view videos in the theater, listen to nautical music, take in interactive displays at the Oregon Maritime Museum. The museum is located at the Willamette River Harbor Wall at the foot of Southwest Pine Street. Admission is $3 to $5. Children 6 and younger are free. For more info, visit www.OregonMaritimeMuseum.org or call 503-224-7724. Thank you for listening to KBOO. Happy holidays to everyone. This is 90.7 Portland, 91.9 Hood River, 100.7 Corvallis.